Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Milwaukee was once called the city that feeds and supplies the world. It was also known as the machine shop of the world. And now there's a book that celebrates Milwaukee's contributions to engineering and industrial design. The Magnificent Machines of Milwaukee and the Engineers Who Created Them was written by Thomas Faring. The former engineer, historian, and author grew up in Milwaukee near the A.O. Smith Factory, and his book includes everything from household names like Harley Davidson and Master Lock to inventions like scuba gear from Desco or the thermostat. Magnificent Machines of Milwaukee has also inspired a new exhibit at MSOE's Grohmann Museum of the same name, which is on display now. To learn more about the machines, the objects, and the artifacts featured in the exhibition, Faring and James Kaselberg, the director of the Grohmann Museum, joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to talk about what factors led to Milwaukee's rapid industrial growth.
What happened is right around the Civil War, Milwaukee began to industrialize, and that activity really started very, very close to where we're at. It occurred right on the banks of the Milwaukee River, just about a mile north of here. Ryan Kilbourne and Increase Latham had built a canal that was never completed. It only had about a mile or so in length, but that canal proved to be a very, very valuable asset because it provided for the first time a possibility of hydropower on the Milwaukee River. And having hydro facilities available allowed companies to move in and then use the hydropower as a resource to drive machinery and to make tooling and make machinery and the like.
What was happening widespread across the U.S. that encouraged more industrial creativity?
Well, you know, the company was rapidly expanding, and in this particular area, you know, grain was coming in off the farm, so we needed milling equipment. And they needed company to build that milling equipment, so that provided an avenue for Milwaukee companies. Similarly, lumber was being harvested and brought in. Trees were being harvested in lumber, and companies needed lumber mills. So that, again, was the opportunity for lumber mill equipment, and Milwaukee was glad to afford that. And then very shortly after that, the steam engine began to become economical and practical, and Milwaukee has a great history of developing the most sophisticated, the most efficient, the most powerful steam engines to drive the various apparatus.
So, James, to bring you into this picture, you are part of the Grohmann Museum, of course, and Tom's book, The Magnificent Machines of Milwaukee and the Engineers Who Created Them, is now an exhibit. So what about Tom's book stood out to you as a natural layout to set up an exhibit?
Well, mainly because he did decades of research in creating the book. About 3 years ago, Tom came to me with the idea that he was creating this book, and he asked me to review specifically the section on MSOE and our founder, Oscar Werwath, and his contributions to Milwaukee industry. And so in reviewing that section, I obviously read the entire tome, and at the time I thought, well, geez, you know, the research being in place as it is, a lot of the photography and the historical assets already included, it's just a matter of gathering the artifacts. And so I presented to Tom the idea. I said, you know, this should become an exhibition. And he agreed 100%. He's wholeheartedly. And so we set about making a wish list of all those implements, those artifacts that we would like to include in the exhibition. And about a year ago, a little over a year ago, we really started in earnest visiting these companies, visiting some of these corporate and local collections, local historical societies, and just started gathering commitments of loan to the exhibition. And so in the show, we have over 26 lenders and over 160 artifacts included. And it's all through the generosity of these kind donors that and lenders that we have encountered over the last year.
Do you find that a lot of these people and companies you were visiting were like, well, gee, no, this would be great. Like, people haven't really paid attention to the history of what Milwaukee has created.
Well, many have. I mean, you know, they kind of recognize that. But many recognize their own history, but they almost take it as a compliment that somebody else
sure
is recognizing that and their contributions and their innovations in Milwaukee's history of industry and technology. And so, yeah, many of them were flattered. The majority, very, very happy to cooperate and be partners in the exhibition. And that's really why it's been so successful, is all the great partnerships we've established over the course of the last year.
Now, Tom, you were a guest curator for this exhibit. What challenges did you find enjoyable in researching what could be used in an exhibit and what artifacts to find, you know, versus the in-depth primary document, more so research that you did for the book? What was it like for you to be able to add this element?
It certainly was a very enjoyable experience. You know, we very early on developed kind of a hit list of the companies we wanted to talk to and the types of artifacts that we wanted to get into the museum. Of course, there were some size issues that we had to deal with. You know, Milwaukee was known for very, very big machinery. And some of the machines that could have been attracted would, you could fit the museum inside the machinery, perhaps. So that was a little bit of a challenge. But we were able to get around that by getting some models. You know, for example, one of the awesome pieces, I think, in the exhibit is a drag line. It's a scale model drag line. It's a 1 to 50 scale, and it stands 4 feet high. You know, so you look at that artifact, and when you realize that machine is 200 feet high, and you try to envision yourself against the tracks of the machinery and stuff like that, it just, you know, gives you a sense as the physical reality. Putting it all together, you know, a lot of it was just a matter of trying to reach the right person in the right companies. You know, sometimes you would approach a company and they, you know, everybody's busy. Then you find just the right person. Sometimes it's the CEO who directs, hey, we want to make sure we're involved in this and that it happens. It was a very fun experience, and James and I really enjoyed searching around. You know, we probably had more than 24 visits to various companies, and I like to say we were in the basements because that's where a lot of the archives are typically kept, as well as attics of representing Milwaukee industry, trying to find the appropriate artifacts to display.
What were some of the most interesting artifacts that you were able to hunt down? How far did you travel for one artifact? What was the farthest distance you traveled for?
Well, we didn't have to travel to collect it, although for a while it looked like we might. We were able to find a Milwaukee-built Merkel motorcycle. Joseph Merkel predated Harley-Davidson in producing motorcycles. He produced it in Milwaukee, very close to where the Harley-Davidson lads grew up. And, we eventually discovered that there was a Merkel motorcycle on display in a very private museum in Hillsdale, New Jersey. And it took us quite a while to approach the individual and actually get him to respond because, you know, here were these Milwaukee folks that are reaching out to him asking if we could borrow this very, very valuable artifact. It was great when, you know, in fact, there was one day that he shared, I think, 3 or 4 messages, all with photographs of the boxing of this Merkel motorcycle because it was very, very carefully packaged and shipped to Milwaukee.
What did you both learn from each other in this process of, you know, first it was the book and bouncing ideas off of that, now with the exhibit?
Well, at the museum, you know, typically we deal with the art of industry. That is, we display paintings, bronzes, works on paper. So this was very much a departure for us as a museum to deal with an artifactual exhibition. So first it was learning all the things that Tom has put down over the past few decades in the book. And I gathered so much information and so many things that I thought I knew, but maybe I didn't have quite right. And so just Tom's scholarship and his compiling all of these great local industrial stories of innovation in the book, that was most educational for me.
Yeah, and that, you know, I kept pressing James and Russ on his staff, you know, geez, what can we package into this exhibit? And you know, for a while, I was tracking down an Ellis Chalmers tractor. I mean, it would have been fun, but it just was a bit too wide to clear the doors. We also would have loved to have had a Nash 600. You know, the Nash auto bodies were produced in Milwaukee, and there were some great accomplishments by Nash automobiles. Ultimately, that resulted in the local Nash Owners Club having a show adjacent and as part of the museum, which was an awful lot of fun because that attracted a lot of people in during the weekend that occurred, as well as early relative of Charles Nash, who, you know, ended up putting a display of early Nash memorabilia in the lobby area, and there were a dozen automobiles out in the street. Plus, we engaged the owners and talked a little bit about the Nash accomplishments. So it turned out to be a lot of fun.
Well, I imagine in your process of looking up what's left, what artifacts are still remaining of these machines and companies, whether they're still around or not today, is that you got to connect with people who are so enthusiastic about this history, whether they were directly involved in the company or not.
Yeah, very, very, very much. And in fact, probably the most emphatic of that has been the descendants of the A.O. Smith Company. You know, we had people coming from all over the country for the exhibit and to engage. In fact, they used the opportunity to visit the archives of the company. These are great-grandsons and you know, related. So they're typically three or fourth generations removed from A.O. Smith and his father, C.F. Smith. But they were just delighted to have the opportunity to visit Milwaukee and to dig into the history of their family and the history of the company.
Now, your book is, of course, about the machines and the industry that was created here, but it's also about the inventors. Did you find, you know, a certain commonality between the inventors that attracted you to these creations as an engineer yourself?
Well, first of all, you know, about half of them were immigrants to the city, immigrants to the country. And it was fun exploring, you know, their background, how they got their knowledge and how they ended up in Milwaukee. It was also, you know, to a person, these people were, they just put an awful lot of activity, a lot of work, a lot of persistence, and sometimes being lucky, being at the market at the right time.
Sure. Let's talk about some of the other machines. Of course, there's not enough time to include all of them, but we touched upon the Merkle motorcycle, which most people wouldn't even hear about outside of Harley here. One thing that is pretty unique is Milwaukee's deep sea dive and scuba history, the Desco. Could you touch upon that?
Yeah, an incredible story, and one that folks wouldn't equate to Milwaukee industry is Desco, Diving Equipment and Supply Company down in Milwaukee's Third Ward. And they developed a deep sea diving apparatus in the, I believe, the 20s. And into the 30s, and it was commissioned in conjunction with the U.S. Navy, and so it was one of those kind of iron helmet or steel helmet apparatus, and they were able to set the deep sea dive record in Lake Michigan in 1937 to a depth of 420 feet. And I know when giving tours through the exhibition since we've been open, that's one of the eye-openers. Folks say, in Lake Michigan, this happened? I mean, you would imagine on the East Coast or the West Coast, you know, in an ocean environment, but right here in Lake Michigan, a depth of 420 feet. And also, the same company invented, and again, in cooperation with the U.S. military, developed what they called a rebreather. And it was effectively one of the first scuba apparatus. And that was designed so they could dive without creating bubbles. And so it was a rebreather that would scrub carbon dioxide and return oxygen to the diver, and almost worked too good in that it was so effective. Divers were getting over-oxygenated, but they refined that over a period of time. But that effectively gave rise to the word scuba, and that's one of those very kind of eye-opening instances of Milwaukee innovation.
One thing I found fun was the Briggs & Stratton Flyer and how this machine eventually turned into a way to power washing machines. You know, they try to market a car or something for kids and adults to use recreationally, and then it's life changed.
Mm-hmm. You know, actually having Briggs & Stratton got the rights to develop something called a motor wheel from A.O. Smith. A.O. Smith had been marketing the device, and they decided to get out of the business to concentrate in some other activities. And so Briggs & Stratton took that business on. And, you know, they ultimately, the motor wheel just didn't take off, I think, the way they would have liked to. But that got them into, for the first time, internal combustion engines, small internal combustion engine business. So they developed a standalone internal combustion engine that could be used for a myriad of activities based upon this little engine that was in this initial motor wheel. And initially, a lot of them went into washing machines in rural areas, farm areas and things like that, that didn't have access to electricity. So you'd hopefully invented it well.
Yes.
But used a small internal combustion engine for that.
Mm-hmm. One thing that Milwaukee's known for, of course, is the QWERTY keyboard. But then Remington typewriters were the first commercially successful typewriters. And you point out that they had a crucial role in advancing women in work.
Well, it did. It did. You know, the typewriter that they developed, it was initially the first commercially successful typewriter, commercially available typewriter, was called the Scholes and Lydon typewriter. Christopher Latham Scholes was the principal inventor, innovator on the device, but he was helped by Matthias Schwalbach and James Densmore and the like. They produced about 30, 35 of them just north of here on the Milwaukee River using, you know, the hydropower of this canal, but they were losing money on each one. And ultimately, they decided to outsource the manufacturing to Remington. And they did that on a contract basis. So the typewriters would arrive with the Scholes and Lydon name on it. They produce them, and eventually Remington saw the potential of the business being so large that they acquired the rights to the typewriter. But they still didn't know exactly, you know, where the best market was. They were trying to market the typewriter to writers like Twain.
Mark Twain.
His name. Mark Twain had a typewriter for a while, didn't quite know what to do with it. He tried to use it for writing a book. Ultimately, they found out that the best market for typewriters ended up being in business. Companies needed typewriters for correspondence, and they needed people who could touch type, which led to the formation of schools to teach people to type. And the schools largely were populated, the classes were largely populated by young women. And for the first time, women were accepted and encouraged to go into the workforce. To work for all of these companies, replacing the guys with the green eye shades and, you know, the meticulous writing and the like. And, of course, they got quite proficient in typing, and it caused a revolution, a social revolution. And it was quite remarkable for its time.
Well, another invention along those lines was Zimmerman's electronic secretary, one of the first voicemail, you know, machines. And I just found that pretty fascinating because he was trying to work around AT&T.
Yeah,
that.
Very, very quirky device.
Yeah.
You know, it's not the direction you would typically go, but of course you follow the logistics of what's practical. AT&T would not allow any devices to be directly tied to its line, and they were very protective of that. So he got around the limitations by just having a device that would lift up the receiver and couple that receiver to a device then that could be used to, both provide a tape message, outgoing tape message saying, presumably, I can't answer my phone right now, please leave me a message, and then they would, another tape device that would actually tape the recording. Okay. And he was quite successful for quite a period of time.
Yeah, from large to small, there's so much covered in this book and the exhibit that is really fascinating. Thomas Faring and James Castleberg, thank you both so much for coming in to touch upon a little bit of it today.
Well, thanks for the opportunity.
No, it's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thomas Faring and James Castleberg are the co-curators of the Magnificent Machines of Milwaukee exhibition that's at MSOE's Grumman Museum. The exhibit is on display now through the end of January, and you can see some photos of the machines featured at wuwm.com.